such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my privilege to be sitting in, as I do most Mondays, for Father Anthony. Hope you all had a very good 4th of July with your family and friends. Another tragically violent weekend in Chicago, sadly, including the deaths of two additional children, a 14-year-old boy and a 7-year-old girl who was shot in the forehead while riding her bike at her grandmother's 4th of July gathering. Certain neighborhoods in Chicago now out of control. This is 3 weekends in a row where we have had more than 50 people shot and more than 10 people murdered. And sadly, every single weekend we have seen children under the age of 12, including a 1-year-old strapped in his car seat and a 3-year-old and now this 7-year-old. So you can hardly wrap your mind around the magnitude here. It is worse than living in a war zone, as one of my police officer friends said to me privately this morning. So with that sort of sad start to the week, we're going to talk about some things that may be more hopeful, maybe just as sad, but we'll see. I am so pleased to be joined for this hour by attorney Andrea Picciotti Baer. Andrea is a graduate of Stanford Law School and wears a variety of hats, the most important of which she is the mother to 10 children. But in addition to doing that, in her free time, she's with the Judicial Education Project and also with the Catholic Association as a legal advisor. She works primarily in the area of civil rights litigation at the appellate level. So she is a very, very smart and talented attorney. And she's going to help me unpack the 3 big Supreme Court decisions that were handed down last week, kind of break it down for those of you who are not lawyers, the good that came out of those, the bad that came out of it, and what is the path for us going forward. So, Andrea, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Oh, Mary, thank you so much. And I hope that I'm going to bring a little bit happier news, although I think that there are some really sad moments in the Supreme Court's term this year as well.
Yeah, there is. It was a disappointing week, a lot of missed opportunities there, in my opinion. And now I know you were a Chicagoan at least for a little while. You went to Northwestern for your undergrad, yes?
I was. So I am from the Midwest. I'm from Michigan. Just if you look across the lake, you'll probably see my folks waving.
Oh, really?
They're in Holland.
Okay, wonderful.
Yeah. They'll probably have like Dutch dancers clumping all around them as well. But
I've been to Holland. Blueberry picking. There's good blueberry picking in Holland.
That was some of my first jobs.
Really?
Riding on a bike in the summer and realizing that I'm really not good at much manual labor, which is why I turned to the law.
There you go. There's no blueberry picking involved in law school, thankfully. I went to law school simply because it involved no math, and I was assured of that. So that was my primary goal, a graduate degree that wouldn't involve math. But other than federal income tax, in which I actually got an A, much to my surprise. But
goodness.
And anyway, I know, even I could pull it off. But so listen, so we've got there's a lot to do. The 3 main cases I was hoping we'll take each of our, 15, 16 minute segments and look at one case. So the 3 I want to look at are Bostock, June Medical, and then Espinoza. So why don't we start with Drew Medical? Because I think that was the one that made the most headlines, that, of course, because abortion is such a pivotal and riveting issue. It is going to be a huge issue in the upcoming November presidential elections, because everything at the end of the day, for many people, comes down to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, and whoever is the next president will likely be nominating one justice, perhaps two, if Justice Breyer retires. So so for most of the people who will be listening today, Andrea, are not attorneys. So can you break down?
Great.
Yes, which is which is good for us, because it makes us sound so much smarter, right, than we actually are. But why don't you, if you could sort of just generally lay out the fact pattern in this Louisiana case. But, you know, I do want to start by saying that the case, the law that the case itself was brought up on, the Louisiana law, was written by an African-American woman. Mm-hmm. Who is a Democrat, who is a pro-life Democrat, and she created this law. She wrote it. She was the primary drafter and sponsor of this bill in the Louisiana legislature because of the way she saw abortion damaging the female constituents in her state in order to protect them better from the abortion industry. So, you know, this was not, you know, cases sometimes you see some of the you know, less well-read people saying, you know, this was just white men trying to impose, you know, their religious values on someone else. So unpack a little bit the fact pattern of the case, please.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Marion, saying that the first takeaway of this this case should be that, just like you said, Representative Katrina Jackson is a Democrat and is an African-American woman in Louisiana, grown up in Louisiana and cared for her people,
right,
especially women in her, saw a problem and was able to get bipartisan agreement on the issue of health and safety regulations of these clinics. And that's a takeaway that's a positive takeaway.
Yes.
That's something that all of our lawmakers at the state, local, national level, we all need to start bridging this divide.
Right.
That seems to be, you know, growing farther and farther.
Well, and Katrina Jackson, sorry to interrupt, was a name many of us knew, right, as pro-life advocates and as women pro-life advocates in particular. But I'm glad to see that it elevated her stature in a way and made her better known, you know, to
absolutely
more people. She released a Twitter video that was excellent. She's extremely articulate. And, you know, the bottom line of her comments right after the case was they have taken the will of the people of Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And again, as you mentioned, bipartisan. She said, I got bipartisan agreement on this bill. And they have just completely ignored the will of the people of this state. And that's wrong. So we have to go back in and keep fighting. But that being said, what would the bill itself have done, the law itself have
done? So we'll step back. So the bill itself focused primarily on admitting privileges for doctors that are performing, or abortionists that are performing abortions in the state, to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic where they're performing abortions.
Okay.
And the reasons for that are twofold from a public policy perspective. The first is it's a credentialing factor. You can know that if somebody passes admitting privileges application, that they're people that are pretty well regarded as far as competent professionals.
Correct, right.
And you can get a medical license, but people like Kermit Gosnell had a medical license.
Right.
And I'm sure that, you know, Klopfer,
Klopfer, yes.
Had a medical license. But whether anyone would want him stepping foot in their hospital is something that I think we could all agree they wouldn't have passed muster. So this admitting privilege requirement was very important to make sure that these doctors knew what they were doing. And in Louisiana, the lawmakers, along with Representative Jackson, found that at clinics, they were hiring medical professionals who had no surgical experience whatsoever. So mm-hmm. there was an ophthalmologist and a radiologist that had been contracted to work at one of the clinics in Shreveport. And so you really see people, you know, it'd be like if you or I were asked to do major corporate litigation documents.
Right.
You know, I just don't know what to do on that. And the product that I'd be able to produce would be probably more often than not terrible.
Right, would reflect and, that, sure. And Louisiana's not, you know, I mean, there was what I've been thinking about lately, back in, I think it was 77 or 78, so just a few years after Roe came down, the Chicago Sun-Times, which remains one of our two remaining daily newspapers in Chicago, did a very groundbreaking investigative series called Meet the Abortion Profiteers, in which they sent women into clinics. They did all sorts of research, medical records, and found filthy, disgusting conditions in these clinics. Women who were rendered sterile, a couple of deaths, instruments being reused and not being sterilized, just rampant, you know, medical mismanagement at these clinics. And then fast forward to Gosnell, who you mentioned, for those who are not familiar with the case of Kermit Gosnell, either rent the movie or get the book, Gosnell, America's Greatest Serial Killer, who was operating a clinic in the Philadelphia area for close to 30 years, I think, and applied three times to the National Abortion Federation, which is sort of a trade association for abortion providers. And not once was he admitted, to their credit, I have to say, but they never reported him. I mean, there were cat feces on the floor and teenagers who had been trained as anesthesiologists. I mean, you couldn't make this up. It reads like a horror novel. And then we have, you know, just last year, the case of Oliver Kopfler, the abortionist who lived here in Illinois but ran three clinics in areas primarily populated by people of color, and was found to have hoarded more than 2,000 fetal remains in the when he passed away in his garage and in the trunk of his Mercedes-Benz. So, and then in Northern Illinois, just a couple years before that, the Illinois Department of Health, again to their credit, shut down the Northern Illinois Women's Center when they found out that they too were not sterilizing instruments after surgical abortions, and they were reusing them on women. So, so this is not, this is a problem that's been going on since right after Roe, and it's been going on pretty much up until this day. So these are not, you know, cherry-picked cases from a few tragic and, you know, really rare sets of circumstances, are they?
No, and the sad thing is exactly what you mentioned. All these horrific stories are what was identified in Louisiana as well. And I don't think we should think of Louisiana as being exceptional. We should think of it as being awake, that they were paying attention, and they're trying to, within the limits of the constitutional right to an abortion, regulate an industry that's really gone unregulated. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say that the second reason behind this admitting privileges law is a pro-woman issue, and that's continuity of care.
Right.
If you've ever received any kind of medical care, you know, you try to pay attention to what's going on, but when there's a lot, something going on as dramatic as an abortion and oftentimes a pregnancy without the supports, the patient herself is in a very fragile state. And if something goes wrong medically in that, you want the doctor to know what had been performed, what had been given, if there was problems with anesthesia and whatnot, and to be able to accompany his or her patient to the hospital if they needed more extreme measures for their care.
Right. Well, I actually have a friend who's an OBGYN here in the Chicago area, and he told me a story one time. He, you know, it was interesting. He had been at the hospital because his wife was giving birth to one of their children, and so he didn't deliver his son, but he was present for the birth, and then he had to go on duty because he was the ER doctor, the supervising OB in the ER for that weekend. So he, you know, left his wife, you know, went over to the ER, and he said he had a 15-year-old with sepsis come in. And she had sepsis because she had had an incomplete abortion, which means that some of the baby's body parts had been left in her. So he said, you know, of course, the only way that you can treat that, right, is to make sure that you've removed. He had to complete the abortion. It was there were still parts of the baby left. So, you know, he said, not to be graphic, but you have to get a pan. You have to go through. You've got to count pieces as they come out and make sure that you have everything. And he said, so, you know, again, he said, you know, for me, he said, I was already emotional because my son had just been born. But he said, I kind of looked up and I noticed that the nurse was crying. They don't do abortions at the hospital where he works. And then he said, I kind of glanced to my side, and he said, the anesthesiologist was crying. And he said, then I started to cry. And he said, the three of us were a hot mess. We're sobbing as we're doing this. So he he said, I was so angry. He said, the minute I walked out, I pulled off my gloves. I called the abortion clinic. I left a message and I said, you just put a 15-year-old septic girl on my table. I want to talk to you. No response. He waited an hour, called again. I need to talk to the doctor who did this abortion. You just sent us a 15-year-old with sepsis. I want to talk to somebody. He tried three times. No idea who the doctor was. No one from the clinic ever called him back. And so, again, thankfully, he saved her. He was able to save her life. But he said, you know, for me, like, what should have happened was that this I should have known this doctor's name, a way to reach him, a way to page him, a way to, to talk to him about what may or may not have gone wrong during that surgery, what method he used. He said, I had to basically, you know, kind of operate blindly to treat this patient. So, you know, these are real, you know, these are really significant situations. And do you read about every one of them in the past? I wouldn't know about this if this man were not my friend and told me, you know, over a
Well, and that's the really hard thing about the kind of cover of darkness that's going on. Because there isn't this continuity of care, terrible things are happening and there's a skip as far as tracking who's responsible. And it's up to people like your friend to fix and save the lives of these, you know, victims. I can only, I don't call them patients. I consider them either victims or clients. You know, but back to this case. So Louisiana spotted all of these problems, came up with this law. The law modeled a law that was passed around the same time in Texas.
Correct. And so this is the Hellerstedt case, right?
Yes. So the Supreme Court, a number of years ago, about 4 years ago, dealt with a similar admitting privileges law in Texas, and they struck it down. And they struck it down in a 5-3 decision. Mm-hmm. Normally the court has 9 justices, but Justice Scalia had just passed away and the seat hadn't been filled. And so that's a really important consideration as far as understanding the context of how the court faced this new Louisiana law.
And in in that Texas case, Justice Roberts sided with the minority, did he not?
Yeah. Yeah. He did. He did. And so he became, you know, people are a little worried about him becoming a traitor. And there are some cases where it seems like he's lacking in courage to do what is right.
Or at least lacking in consistency. Yeah. I mean, if it was wrong the first time he read the case, it should have been wrong again. But anyway, go ahead.
And so what ended up happening is, four of the more left-leaning justices on the court said, hey, this is just like the Texas case. We don't see anything different. We're going to say that there's a substantial obstacles were placed in a woman's right to access an abortion by this admitting privileges law, case over. And joining that plurality was Chief Justice Roberts, and he said, I still hate the Texas decision, but as an institutionalist, I have to obey that that's what we decided before.
Right, what's called stare decisis, that this has already been decided. And he went on a bit much about, I remember that was my very first comment. I was tweeting another lawyer friend of ours. I'm like, what on earth is this with the stare decisis in this case?
Yeah.
Like, talk a little bit about that, because this is a really key point to the case.
It is. And in general, I would agree with Roberts, just not in this case.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, our judiciary works because we're not changing our mind every other day.
Right.
We have cases, and that another case, especially if it fits a similar fact pattern, or you can't distinguish it. And I want to mention that I think that Louisiana's was distinguishable, different than Texas.
Right.
But if you can't distinguish it, you kind of have the same rule, and it's called the precedent. And for folks that love Latin, stare decisis is let the decision stand.
Right.
And so it the idea behind that is it helps rule of law. It allows us to understand what to expect if the same kind of problem comes up. The problem with applying that in this Louisiana case, the June medical case, is the precedent's bad.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a bad precedent, it does not serve the ends of justice by repeating it. And that's where I think the problem came in with this decision. Now, I do think that there's a lot of hope. And Roberts, for all of the spinelessness of his decision, gave a bit of a roadmap for moving forward.
Right. And so this is sort of the silver lining. This is what everyone is talking about. Was he being, you know, crazy like a fox here and actually giving us sort of a, you know, a map, as you say, to overturning maybe parts of Casey? So unpack that a little bit. So he essentially says, I think Hellerstedt was wrongly decided. Doctors should have admitting privileges at hospitals. That serves a legitimate state interest in protecting not only women, but also the state does have a legitimate interest that was even articulated in Roe in protecting unborn life.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And, you know, the issue is that the devil's always in the details, right? And so the plurality, these four kind of more liberal-leaning justices said, what we're going to do is advance a new test for use whenever there's an abortion regulation. And we're going to call that a balancing test. We're going to balance out the burdens on a woman's access to abortion versus the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And Roberts comes along and says, whoa, wait a minute. That isn't the standard that we're using. Instead, the standard should be assume in general that a regulation is valid, and we only invalidate it if it's a substantial obstacle on a woman's access. Now, for, you know, when reading that, you're like, what the kind of difference does that make?
Right.
And it really does make a difference as far as what your starting point is. If you think that the judges are there to kind of second-guess lawmakers, then the benefits and burdens balancing test is the right way to go.
Right.
But if you want to defer, just like Katrina Jackson was saying, to the home state lawmakers who really do have the authority from the people to enact laws, then you're going to start from a place of assuming that, in general, regulations are going to be tied towards the needs of the people.
Right.
And
have gone through a process where, you know, there was an actual process where experts were called in, where people were testified, where lawmakers had an opportunity to question experts presented by both sides, and then you vote, right? It's not there's an actual deliberative process that goes on in the state legislatures, which are supposed to be the pot kettle of justice, correct? Right, where these things are all worked out.
Absolutely. And that's where, you know, to show, in my opinion, why June was different than Texas is the Louisiana lawmakers had developed that record to the fullest extent.
Right.
They had brought in women who had these horrible situations happen, investigators looking at clinics where they had rusty instruments and single-use supplies that were used repeatedly over and over again. The other thing that's very interesting about this is the pro-abortion movement will call any regulation a trap regulation, a targeted regulation for abortion.
Intimidation providers. Laws. They're intimidation laws, Andrea. Yes.
No, and what's very interesting about the Louisiana case is the abortionists have an exception. All other surgical ambulatory centers, their surgeons or their doctors need to have admitting privileges. This was just bringing abortionists into the general rule.
Correct.
So instead of targeting, it was basically erasing an exception. An exception that has ended up putting women, you know, and obviously their unborn children in terrible danger. So it's very interesting how the spin happens. But I think, you know, what we've seen, and there have been, I think it was last week, some cases that were sent back in involving regulations in Indiana and in Illinois, saying, look at these regulations in light of this decision. And I think that there's hope. There's hope that regulations that touch upon different aspects of the industry and the procedure can finally be upheld and recognized as a legitimate oversight by government.
Well, on that note, we're going to go to our first break. When we come back, Andrea, let's wrap up the discussion on June Medical and then move on. I'd like to move on to Espinoza because we do have so many of our listeners who send their children to Catholic schools or want to. And so this was a pretty significant step forward in perhaps getting Catholic schools and other religious schools back on some equal footing with government schools. So, listeners, please don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. To register and to participate in the Holy Mass, and for more information, go to ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. During this COVID-19 virus pandemic, offering you prayer and inspiration through your faith.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
I think it's time to get some lunch. Lunch. It's time for lunch. Lunch.
Yes, there is a free lunch. You can find chicken tenders, mac and cheese, pizza, pancakes, and more for children under 18 years of age in each household, available for grab-and-go curbside pickup Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 1:30 p.m. at Holy Trinity High School, 1443 West Division. The children don't have to be Holy Trinity students. Holy Trinity High School has partnered with Country House on the ISBE Summer Food Service Program. Enjoy Country House's signature made from scratch cooking and fun snack packs to brighten your summer. To find out more about the free lunch at Holy Trinity High School, call 708-389-4618. That's 708-389-4618. Come and enjoy meals every day.
Let's eat!
Anybody got an extra spork? I lost mine.
Because of the unprecedented COVID-19 virus pandemic, the Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's needs your immediate help. The Soup Kitchen is asking for your donations of water, juice boxes, individual food servings, hand sanitizers, and Lysol. The Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's is operating regular hours during this pandemic. The Soup Kitchen is operated by the Daughters of St. Mary Providence from the basement of St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, which serves over 21,000 meals per year. To offer your help, please call Sister Darlene at 773-870-2435. That number again is 773-870-2435. Thank you.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., as well as the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And I am joined this hour by the woman we call the legal eagle in our little inner circle, Andrea Picciotti Bear, who is, among other things, the mother of 10, a Stanford law grad, Northwestern undergrad, whose expertise is civil rights law at the appellate level in particular. Andrea, just a kind of quick personal side note. You know, so many of my friends who read your resume are just so amazed at how you balance 10 children with everything that you do in the law, because, you know, writing amicus briefs, which is, I know, something that you are very heavily involved in right now, is such a time intensive and sort of really needing mental focus. Do you have any kind of hints just for those of us who, you know, maybe can't operate at the same level you do? Any advice you could give to other working moms?
You know, I actually think the best advice I can give is be very honest with yourself. There was a time where I was working at the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division doing appellate work, and I had 4 little boys at the time, and I realized I was called to be a mom first. Mm. And so I took time off. And fortunately, for a lot of moms, we can onboard again.
Right.
And so after 13 years, I truly believe it's a miracle. But you can go in and out of the workforce, but your kids will always, you know, as there is a very good lock on my office door, and currently there's a chair making sure that my four-year-old doesn't open the door while we're chatting. But,
right.
you know, be realistic. Don't try to be perfect in everything. Try to be the best you can in what counts most, which is your family.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's a very helpful, you know, reminder. I always think of that poor man who was doing the BBC interview.
I love,
you know,
that
on
guy.
Skype. I know. And then the kids, the one daughter marches in, and then the little baby scoots in his walker, and then the poor mother tries to crawl.
You know, Mary, there was a woman just recently on BBC again. They must have something with BBC, but she's doing a live show, and her girl comes up behind her and starts rearranging, like, picture frames.
Oh, no, that's hilarious. That's like my greatest fear, that someone, you know, or someone will scream, or there'll be a fight will break out over something. My girls are all either preteens or teens now. So, but I remember those days, and, you know, you would be handing like an entire Hershey bar in small pieces to one of my children one time just to keep her quiet while I was on doing a radio interview. But anyway, but it's, I mean, God's given
but
you gifts. And yes, we digress.
No,
okay.
Lovely.
So let's get, speaking of children, let's move to Espinoza. So Espinoza versus the Montana Department of Revenue, which doesn't sound like it would be a particularly exciting case for any reason, but it really has to do with the Blaine Amendments and Catholic schools. Let's first start by talking about Blaine Amendments. And if there's, you know, there's quite a bit of American history that's rooted in some significant anti-Catholic bigotry, but this was among the most obnoxious and really reaching forms of bigotry, because it has kept so many Catholic families out of the type of education they would have chosen for their children otherwise. But can you kind of briefly explain the Blaine Amendments and then what this particular case did?
Absolutely. Now, this is something that I didn't know of before, and it shows kind of the blind spots in my own understanding of U.S. history. And I think, you know, again, this is a great opportunity for everyone to celebrate putting behind a terrible stain of discriminatory hatred against a big part of the American population, in this case Catholics, putting it behind us, or hopefully putting it behind us. In the late 1800s, as probably a lot of people know, there was an influx of Catholic immigrants. And the influx of immigrants made things very uncomfortable for Protestant Americans at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were concerned about increasing voter power by Catholics, and they were also concerned about the channeling of funds away from public schools, which at the time were predominantly Protestant. Because
mm-hmm.
Catholic families didn't want their kids reading from the King James Bible. They wanted their kids having a Catholic education,
right.
And they wanted to get public funds for Catholic parochial schools. So there was a big tension within Protestant and Catholic communities, and in walks in House Speaker from Maine, James G. Blaine. And he had incredible political ambitions, which would always tell us, whenever you're ambitious, you're going to do something terrible.
Right.
And
usually, yeah. Yeah.
So, Blaine took the lead from President Grant at the time, and he proposed an amendment to the First Amendment, and it basically was going to bar any public funds from going to any quote-unquote sectarian or religious sect,
mm-hmm.
which was code word for Catholic.
Right.
His attempt failed at the federal level, but many states picked up on it. And a number of would-be or soon-to-be states also picked up on it, and their offer for coming into the union was conditioned on implementing what they called later state Blaine Amendments into their state constitutions.
Right.
And Montana was one of them. Montana had a Blaine Amendment in its territorial constitution and then put it into their state constitution when they were admitted into the union. And the best way to describe it is it's a no-aid provision.
Right.
And it's basically saying that no state monies can go to fund any religious institutions or religious schools. And it was in Montana used to, they used the phrase sectarian.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, it was blatantly anti-Catholic. Over time, it's become anti-religious.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been used to bar, you know, textbook fund programs for private religious schools in New Mexico. And in Montana, the Montana state lawmakers came up with a tax incentive program for private scholarships going to private private schools.
Mm-hmm.
When they were implementing this program, the Montana Department of Revenue said, okay, the program looks great, but the scholarships can't go to religiously affiliated schools.
Hmm.
And to their credit, three single moms who sent their kids or send their kids to Christian schools, not even Catholic schools,
right,
said, wait a minute. And they filed suit in state court saying that that limitation affected their free exercise of religion rights,
mm-hmm,
under the First Amendment. They won at the lower court level, but at the state Supreme Court level, the Supreme Court of Montana said, you're right, our state Blaine Amendment won't allow money to go to religiously affiliated schools, so we're going to dissolve the entire scholarship program for all kids.
Hmm.
And it's really, it's kind of sad because it was a tax incentive, not for donations that would benefit your own kid, just for any donation.
Right.
And it would get yearly $150, dollar for dollar. So if I donated $150 to the Big Sky Scholarship Fund,
right,
I would get $150 credit off of my state taxes.
Okay.
It's not, you know, that's not huge, but for poorer folks in Montana, it's
sure,
significant.
So what kind of private schools would it fund this? So they just couldn't be religious private schools, but it could be, say, a Waldorf school or a Montessori school. Was that sort of the gist of it?
That was the gist. The challenge is over 60% of private schools in Montana are religiously affiliated.
Right.
The bulk of those are Catholic schools.
Right.
But there are other Christian schools and other religious schools that are in Montana.
Yeah, actually, in our area, in the Chicago area, when I was growing up, the Missouri Synod Lutherans had a significant school system here, to the point that they had two high schools, Luther North and Luther South, and mm-hmm, on both the north and south sides of Chicago. They had a significant network of elementary schools, not anything that approached the Catholic schools because, you know, Catholics made up a much larger geographical part of the population, but the Orthodox Jewish day schools and the Missouri, mm-hmm, Synod Lutheran schools were also, and then evangelical Christian schools kind of started to spring up a little bit more in the mid to late 80s. But it also, what people don't understand, and this is a point that, you know, the cardinal archbishops in Chicago have tried to make, is that imagine if all these kids, I got to take all my kids and I got to put them in your schools now, Governor. What is going to happen? Do you know the burden on taxpayers?
Mm-hmm.
And
what's interesting,
go ahead.
What's interesting, Mary, is dollar for dollar Catholic schools in particular are a much more efficient school to educate kids than public schools. It's much cheaper.
Right. They do more for less.
Or we do a better job.
Right.
We do a better job.
Right, right. And you know, there was an argument that was made at one point when in Illinois we were trying to kind of work out something similar, that, you know, the Catholic schools, you know, pluck the best and the brightest, and that's why they, you know, they kind of skim those kids off the top, and what's left for the government schools to educate are just kids who, you know, have more difficulty learning, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember Cardinal Bernardine at one point saying, like, do you really think we're, like, taking kids from Winnetka and putting them in schools in Englewood? Are you kidding me? Like, where do you, like, they come from the exact same community. So, you know, the exact same number of single moms, you know, which is about, in the African-American community here, about 75% of all families are headed up by a single mother. You know, we're not trying to go in and poach wealthy families for our schools. I mean, the very suggestion that in the most, you know, economically challenged neighborhoods. And as, you know, I opened the show, I talked about the crime in these neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. You know, our schools are just haven. Catholic schools are havens of, you know, of peace and of order and of discipline in parents who are so desperate to have them. And, you know, I have a dear friend who is a Protestant African-American pastor on the South Side, Pastor Cesar LaFleur. He pastors a church called the Beloved Community. And I remember, yeah, I had him on the show here one time, and this was right after a large West Side in the Austin neighborhood where that little girl was shot over the weekend. We had closed down one of our schools. And he said to me, you know, I don't know what it is, but every time you all close one of your churches and your schools, something leaves the neighborhood. Now, mm-hmm. I'd like to believe that's the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. You know, you can look at it the way you want, but there was actually a study done, I think it was by the Chicago Sun-Times, that showed that when religious schools closed, but this study focused particularly on Catholic schools, but I think also some of the Lutheran ones, that the crime rate and the violence rate went up in the community.
Well, and just as far as, you know, we all want the future generation to have as many options as possible for them to thrive.
Right.
One of the things that we did, I filed an amicus brief in this Espinosa case, and I interviewed Catholic school families in Montana, in rural places of Montana, and folks who were, you know, middle income or low income, some single parents, somewhere, you know, a father had a job injury that prevented him from working anymore, and so mom was supporting the whole family. And their real stories are about only wanting their kids to have a better option
right.
than the local school. And I'm, you know, half product of parochial school, half of a public school. So I don't want to trash public schools, but when they fail, you don't want it to be your kid.
Right,
and
who does?
And,
you know,
and when you have a great complement in a private school, I think it helps the public schools to up their game as well.
Yeah. Well, so what's the outcome? What did the Supreme Court rule in this Espinosa case, and what do you think it will change?
So the Espinosa case was a great victory. It's a great victory because the court, in this case, Chief Justice Roberts, took on the bigoted history of the Blaine Amendments and said, if you're going to offer state subsidies for private schools, you can't discriminate based on the religious character of the school. So basically, it's got to be open to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the court was relying on cases, this precedent of just a few years ago, which I do believe was good, involving a tire recycling program for building playgrounds
mm-hmm.
in Missouri.
That case out of Missouri, right, yeah. And that was a Lutheran school case, was it not?
It was.
Yeah.
And basically this Lutheran preschool said, we want to resurface our playground using this state recycling program funds. And the Blaine Amendment in Missouri got in the way until the Supreme Court came and said, no. You have to treat qualified grant applicants equally. You can't discriminate against religion. And that's what they said in Espinosa. You need to treat qualified schools the same, regardless of their religious character. The impact is going to be huge because there are over 35 states that have some kind of no-aid Blaine Amendment in their constitutions, and many of those state lawmakers want to open up greater school choice for the families in their state. And now they're being, you know, given, basically empowered by the Supreme Court to do so. To do so both for, you know, the secular as well as the religious schools to allow kids to be able to find the right fit for them.
Right. And so what, you know, just there's so many parents here I know, you know, there's nothing that makes me more sad when I see a family that's been generous and open to life and like you has 10 kids or maybe 7 kids and they look at Catholic school tuition and they just say, there's just no way I can do it, you know, and it that to me is so heartbreaking because, you know, as our mutual friend Mary Rice Hassan has pointed out in a lot of mm-hmm. her scholarship, public schools are not neutral. And they're certainly not neutral in Illinois, where now we have new law that just went into effect July 1st, where by 8th grade, every student must be given a comprehensive course in LGBTQ history. And so, you know, regardless of how that history, correct, and rights. And, you know, we used to have in Illinois, in Chicago in particular, Catholic Charities ran what was considered the most successful and greatest model. I think you and I have talked about this on another occasion, adoption agency, you know, in the state. Now, in Chicago, at least, Catholic Charities, we can't do adoptions anymore because we do not place children with same-sex couples. So it... you know, what sort of the practical impact would you say, is this something perhaps parents in Illinois or in Indiana or Wisconsin could look forward to seeing, at least with the tax credit scholarship sort of thing? We have something like that in Illinois, but I just think what parents are really saying is, you know, even if I have to pay $10,000 of a $20,000 scholarship, it still might as well be $10 million. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And they're trying to save for college, and they're trying. So what do you think? I mean, I know this is a big question to ask because it has so many different, you know, moving parts to it. But what do you see as really kind of maybe, say, 2 years down the line? What would the educational landscape, what could it look like?
You know, I think first I want to just respond to the comment about the cost.
Yes.
You know, people will tell you never have children because you'll never have enough money. And of course you'll never have enough money.
Yeah, that's right.
But you're going to make different decisions and you're going to reprioritize. And one of the things that I've always seen both in my own experience and even in Montana talking to these folks is where there's a will, there's a way. There's an incredible amount of tuition support that you can find, especially at the parochial school level. So don't give up if you're considering that. Or if you're a grandmother or grandfather and you want to encourage your kids to send their grandkids to parochial schools, don't give up when you look at the tuition cost on the website. Keep asking. The second is, I think we've all learned from the pandemic that education is really, really important. It's one of those basic necessities for our kids and the stability of our family. And so when we focus on whether the schooling went well or not, it really will tell how the house is doing. And if we have a good partner, and Catholic schools and other religious schools are often better partners because they really care about the person, the student, you know, and there are great public school teachers out there, and God bless them all. But as an institution, Catholic schools and religious schools as an institution care much more about their students, and especially their students getting to heaven, which is, you know, the end
which
game.
Is the key, right, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting to me, you know, the majority of public school teachers in the public school system in Chicago, at least, don't send their children to Chicago public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes, you know, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who sends her child to a parochial Catholic school. So we are going to take our next break. Andrea, our final break, actually, the hour is flying by as it often does, and we'll have just a few minutes, but I'd like to go over the Bostock case just very briefly because it's being portrayed and celebrated, of course, as this just all it is about equality and treating people fairly. But there's a very frightening underside for women, women's sports, women's colleges, women's high schools lying in the Bostock case. And I want to get your opinion on that. So, listeners, please don't go away. We've just got 12 more minutes left with Andrea Picciotti-Bear. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site to register and to participate in the Holy Mass. And for more information, go to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
I think it's time to get some lunch. Lunch. It's time for lunch. Lunch.
Yes, there is a free lunch. You can find chicken tenders, mac and cheese, pizza, pancakes, and more or children under 18 years of age in each household, available for grab-and-go curbside pickup Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 1:30 p.m. at Holy Trinity High School, 1443 West Division. The children don't have to be Holy Trinity students. Holy Trinity High School has partnered with Country House on the ISBE Summer Food Service Program. Enjoy Country House's signature made-from-scratch cooking and fun snack packs to brighten your summer. To find out more about the free lunch at Holy Trinity High School, call 708-389-4618. That's 708-389-4618. Come and enjoy meals every day.
Let's eat! Anybody got an extra spork? I lost mine.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And I have been joined this past hour, which has flown by attorney Andrea Picciotti Bear, who is a civil rights former DOJ, yes, correct?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
A civil rights attorney for the Department of Justice. And we have been discussing the Supreme Court cases, the decisions that have been handed down at the end of this term. A couple of really hot, if there's anything that can be more hot button than the abortion cases, it is the cases involving LGBTQ plus issues. And that's what we had in the Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia case, actually, which combined two cases, Andrea. So why don't you tell the listeners a little bit more about what those cases were and what the outcome was?
You know, Mary, you're right. It's definitely very charged, the Bostock decision. It was three cases.
It was three, not two. Okay, pardon me.
Yeah, no, but two were similar. Two were gentlemen who claimed that they were fired from their jobs because of their sexual orientation, because they announced that they were gay, and then later they were terminated. A third case is just, I can't even imagine being the employers in this case. It was a funeral home in Michigan, and one of the front guys that would receive the grieving families decided after 2 years working for them that he would like to present himself as a woman. And he informed his employers, and his employers said, "Oh my gosh, we're so worried about you, but you can't do that. You can't dress as a woman and put on makeup when you're receiving grieving families, because it's not about you.
Right.
It's about them.
Right.
And we have a dress code." And this gentleman, who's since passed away, very sad, but filed suit with the EEOC, and they said that, you know, this was unlawful employment discrimination on the basis of sex.
Right.
And so the decision is really, what does based on sex mean? And writing for the majority, Justice Neil Gorsuch, who's, you know, the kind of a brilliant mind who made a mistake,
right,
in this case, said, whenever you are discriminating based on sexual orientation or someone's quote-unquote gender identity, you necessarily refer to their sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so by that reference, we have to conclude that you discriminate on the basis of sex.
Mm-hmm.
And joining him were the liberal-leaning justices, the kind of crew of expected folks, but also Chief Justice Roberts, which was, you know, a big disappointment.
We mentioned before,
it's not been a good term,
right,
for Roberts. And, you know, what's very, very difficult, and I almost feel like you don't want to read the majority opinion, because very smart people sometimes get hooked on their own cleverness.
Right.
And I think that that's what happened with Justice Gorsuch, is he had this idea that he thought was just so bright, and he got so invested in it that he couldn't back away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was applauded by the brethren that joined him. Meanwhile, three other justices were saying, "What? What's going on?" Title VII, which is the federal employment discrimination law, never meant to include sexual orientation or this new concept of gender,
right,
identity.
Correct.
And if Congress wants to do it, they can pass an amendment. And they've had the chance on three separate occasions, and they never have. A lot of state and local governments do have sexual orientation in their anti-discrimination policies.
Right.
And so you can file, you know, claims at the state based on these state claims. The only silver lining, because I don't want this to be a total downer episode, Mary, is that Justice Gorsuch left open a window, and it's a window based on religious objections. And none of the employers in this case raised before the Supreme Court religious-based defenses.
Correct,
but we know that there's a federal Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, and that is an option in which people can defend against this kind of burden on their religious exercise. And there's also a case that's probably going to come in the next few days dealing with something called the ministerial exception.
Mm-hmm.
And to tie it back into our schools.
Right. That's an important case to watch. So what, in the minutes we have left,
it's called Our Lady of Guadalupe, and it deals with two parochial schools
mm-hmm.
in Los Angeles, where Catholic school teachers were terminated. They were religion teachers, or I think they were fifth grade teachers, which
mm-hmm.
we all know
includes
teach a good amount
religion.
Of religion.
Oh, of course they do, sure.
And they were fired. One filed a claiming that she was fired in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The other, based on her age, in violation of the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. They weren't sexual orientation or gender identity lawsuits, but the notion of Title VII being applied in a Catholic school context is a frightening one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can imagine a man coming in dressed in, you know, wearing stilettos, wanting to teach third graders religion.
Right.
And a Catholic school saying, no, we can't.
Right.
So hopefully the court is going to clarify that the ministerial exception includes teachers, basically that the government can't second guess a church's hiring and firing decisions. And that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is going to be a defense when someone based on firmly held, sincerely held religious beliefs cannot condone anything so antithetical to the human person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, we have to love all people.
Mm-hmm.
But if we encourage and support and celebrate behavior that's not in their best interest or for the good of their soul,
mm-hmm.
We have to be very careful about being complicit in their downfall. So
right.
I think that Bostick is definitely a very, very poorly decided case,
mm-hmm.
And hopefully there's going to be some exceptions to it that we're not celebrating what is wrong.
I think it doesn't bode well for those two high school sprinters in Connecticut, does it, the two girls who brought suit because they had to race, who I think would have won probably state titles, but they were racing against transgender boys and lost the races to these boys who now identified as girls.
No, and you're right. Hopefully this Title VII doesn't spill over to Title IX.
Yeah, well, I'm praying that will be the case. Well, Andrea Picciotti-Bear, thank you so much for the generous gift of this past hour. It's been amazing speaking with you and very informative. And listeners, I'll post the link to the talk in about a half an hour to our conversation today. In the meantime, have a wonderful week. God bless you.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed. To say when right from wrong has become so obscure. It
does not take that.